All right, the time is 1 minute in the half 6 o'clock. A very good morning to you, dear listeners. And of course, welcome to another edition of the Early Morning Scoop, where we update you on the economic, trade policy, entrepreneurship, and of course, everything you need to thrive in life, actually. So we appreciate you to always choosing us. And of course, I'm your host, Lois Ashimi. I'll be with you until the half 7:30 just to keep you informed. But before I give you the international news segment, please, before that, do not forget to follow us on social media platform. Connect with us, Eagle FM Namibia, on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn, as well as the Vrij Newspaper page on the on Facebook, Instagram, and of course the channel that which is now the WhatsApp channel, that is Eagle FM Media House. Please don't forget to subscribe and catch up with us daily for the daily news update. And of course the newspaper, and like today the newspaper is out, please don't forget to rather connect there with us on the channel, or rather you can send through your detail to 081-200-4144. 081-200-4144. There's a number you can save, so that at least you can send through your detail, that is your name, your number, your email, to be getting the newspaper every day it's released. That's Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And please don't forget to download the Eagle FM app, available on Google Play Store and the App Store, just to ensure that you stay informed wherever you go, wherever you are, beloved. Now, to start internationally, is that the conflict in Sudan has decimated critical infrastructure, including power stations, water plants, a hospital, and oil refineries, now leaving the country with mounting losses. Oil output dropped by more than half, and with its main refinery destroyed, Sudan now expect crude. Officially say rebuilding will require starting from scratch, and admits the ongoing conflict with a negative economic impact. We might take a listen to this particular discussion.
As blackouts, empty water stations, and looted hospitals across Sudan bear witness to the devastating impact on infrastructure from 2 years of war. Authorities estimate hundreds of billions of dollars worth of reconstruction would be needed.
If we calculate the losses in the electricity sector, water plants and other service facilities like hospitals and other buildings, they exceed millions or billions. They exceed billions of dollars.
The Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces have been battling since April 2023, with tens of thousands of people killed or injured and about 13 million uprooted in what aid groups call the world's worst humanitarian crises.
All commercial centers distributing electricity in Khartoum were destroyed, all of them. All the transformers have been destroyed. Some of the units were thrown in the Nile. There could have been room for maintenance. Out of 100 transformers, we could have gotten 3, 4, or 5 good ones. But all of them now are destroyed. That's why we are moving forward as if Khartoum was brand new. We will start supplying it with electricity as if it was new. This is how we are thinking.
Residents of the capital, Khartoum, have to endure weeks-long power outages and clean water in overcrowded hospitals. Their airport is burnt out with shells of planes on the runway.
Before the war, we used to produce 60,000 barrels of petrol at the main oil refinery in Khartoum. These are technical issues because of the disturbance in the country, but it was actually 60,000 barrels of petrol. Now, we barely produce 24,000 barrels of petrol.
Most of the main buildings in downtown Khartoum are charred, and once wealthy neighborhoods are ghost towns with destroyed cars and unexploded shells dotting the streets.
We are estimating the damage to be in the hundreds of billions of dollars, probably around $300 billion. We are looking at extensive damage to infrastructure like power stations and water plants. All the facility, the health facility in Khartoum, have been damaged.
Other parts of central and western Sudan, including the Darfur region, are similarly ravaged by fighting, while the extensive damage on Khartoum once the center of service provision reverberates across the country.
All right, there you have it. Now to move on to the next item is that the AU's World Food Programme warned that 52 million people in West and Central Africa could face severe food shortages between June and August if urgent aid is not delivered.
Menial jobs such as washing and cleaning for a fee. She says feeding her family has become more difficult lately.
Honestly, food affordability is a challenge to many of us in Nigeria who are not rich. Many times we just cope with whatever is available, not minding the nutritional makeup. The little jobs I do don't pay me much. Same for my husband, and food items are very expensive.
Cecilia is among millions of people in West and Central Africa who are struggling to put food on the table. Officials of poultry and other agricultural associations say insecurity in the region is to blame for current food shortages, as it has forced many farmers to flee their land and stop growing crops.
A lot of farmers cannot go to the farm. The few that have gone to the farms did not come back alive. So the ones that want to go to the farm will either consider their life or going to the farm. And a lot of them that go to the farm are not just farming for their sake, they're also farming for the society as well.
The Nigerian military wants to see local communities play their part in restoring security in the affected areas.
The herding and farming communities must educate their wards on the need to take conscious steps against farm destruction and attack on cattle, as well as cattle poisoning, which are often the major crisis triggers.
Over 10 million people, many of them farmers, have been displaced by insecurity in Nigeria and other countries in West and Central Africa. Many of them, including a huge number living in camps for the displaced, rely on humanitarian aid just to get by. Aid agencies estimate that at least 33 million people across Nigeria are likely to face serious hunger between June and August, which is usually regarded as the lean season. That's up from 26.5 million last year. The government has been trying to improve security in food processing areas to encourage farmers to go back to their land and grow crops.
We will continue to clear criminal elements from their hideouts and maintain increased patrols to identify flashpoints in conjunction with other security agencies. Peace is not a favor we do for one another, but it is a necessity for collective survival. The future will remain a mirage if we do not act decisively today.
The World Food Programme says it's seeking over $700 million to help people facing serious hunger.
Agriculture experts say things could get worse if that amount is not gathered, with more people plunging into a hunger challenge leading to increased crime, malnutrition and deaths, especially among children.
Nigeria says it's partnering with other countries in efforts to combat insurgents and other criminals. People like Cecilia are looking forward to better times, but for now the
All right, the time is 10 minutes in the half 6 o'clock. This early morning scoop. Now to move on to the next item is that we should listen to this particular update on how South Africa's youth and young entrepreneurs can benefit from G20.
Welcome back. Now, a large portion of the world's youth reside in G20 countries. And while the G20 provides platforms for the youth to engage on policy and have influence on various global issues, just how can South Africa's youth, with an unemployment rate of 46% and young entrepreneurs, benefit from the upcoming G20 meeting in November? Innocentia Mutau, SA representative of the G20 Young Entrepreneur Alliance, joins us with her take. Innocentia, thanks so much for your time this afternoon. And let's start there, right? Talking about the role that the G20 Young Entrepreneurs Alliance plays in the grander scheme of things in terms of influencing policy shift as well.
Thank you for having me, and thank you to the viewers back at home. It's a big story. It's a big, broad story of 20 top countries, 20 top economies. So The alliance itself is comprised of business organizations that look after interest of young business people. In it, we meet at a platform. We conversate about what makes entrepreneurs to lose sleep.
Yeah.
And then we go back and talk to the policy custodians, which is our government. Let me tell you a bit about the alliance. So we actually are called the G20 Young Entrepreneurs South Africa Foundation. 14 years formed in 2011, and we are hosting because our president raised his hand to host. Over time, when we meet at that platform, one is to connect with other entrepreneurs. So we take young South Africans to an alliance summit at a hosting country, and they connect, they network, they talk business among themselves. Post that, we develop a document called the communique. In that communique, we highlight themes of all problematic sections of our businesses, be it in policy support, access to finance, access to markets, and being very globally and flat, so that the G20 countries can do business together. That document is then signed by the leaders, Young Entrepreneur Alliance leaders, and then brought back to our governments for them to see. Then we have dialogues of saying, how do we make this happen? How do we convert this into action? Where is it going to find expression in our business from a policy perspective? And that's how the dialogue pretty much starts from our alliance point of view.
And then talking about that dialogue and, you know, turning what we talk about into action and implementation, talk to me about the kind of opportunities this kind of alliance presents for, you know, young entrepreneurs in the country.
Yeah, so we're expecting close to about 600 plus young entrepreneurs from G20 countries as well as invited countries, Singapore, Sri Lanka, Nepal, I think. And there it's where us South Africans need to go present their export-ready products to connect with their peers, and also even those that are not even in business but aspiring to be in business. These kind of platforms are quite key for them, you know, to create that aspiration, to get that motivation to say, entrepreneurship is actually the future for job creation.
Mm-hmm.
Let's all come together and work on it. The biggest challenge I think we're facing as we're building up to our event in September is the education and induction of our South African young people who don't even know what G20 is all about,
yep.
Right? So what's the point of us as platform creators hold a summit where only those that know will benefit? So we, as YESA, we are actually getting into an induction roadshow to help and educate our young business people and get them up to be export ready, mm-hmm. you know, and they must know what they need to take out of the conference. It's not just about attending. It's about packaging themselves prior to the conference. Be specific about what they want to go share with the world, because the world will be like, oh, good product. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow, let me sign up. Are you ready? We need to get that readiness going for them. Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of a big opportunity for us.
And really an opportune time to have those export-ready products, considering where we are when it comes to trade across the globe, right? Let's look at, you know, the local landscape. I highlighted at the top that we sit with an unemployment rate of or youth unemployment rate of about 46%. Growth really stagnant as well. Here at home, do we have a conducive environment for these entrepreneurs to thrive?
We do. I think policy does talk a lot about opening up doors for young entrepreneurs, creating funds that are, you know, catalysts to getting them to do business. But my issue tends to always lean around the education part of it.
Okay.
They don't reach out much to young people to show them products they have. I mean, I just been to a session of a bank where we learned about a product, but I was fortunate enough to learn about a product there. Who else would know about that product? So there's a lot of lack actually and deficit in terms of marketing products that are out there to encourage young people to start businesses. One business in Soweto, a spaza shop selling food, can create 5 jobs,
mm-hmm.
number one. Do we talk about those conversations? We talk about opportunities a lot, but in terms of them putting them back to life, we've been thin on that, and it's where we need to focus. And I think the G20 opportunity for the country is that time,
mm-hmm.
is that opportunity, is this event that's going to bring that vibrancy of more conversations and more impact-driven, you know, projects. We must celebrate success. So I might want a business, but I won't know how it looks like. So I imagine it. It's an idea. I've ideated. But I don't know how it looks like. We need billboards of success stories of young people who are in business so that we can create that inclusivity, that yearn to want to know why is she on the billboard. So we I think as a country we need to just build that capacity of communicating opportunities and putting them to life,
yes.
and celebrating the successes.
So you mentioned issues around
All right. There you have it. The time is 16 minutes in the after 6 o'clock and it is early morning scoop. Now to move on to the next item in Zambia is that a livestock farmers in Chirundu and Namara, a district of Southern Province, have received a major boost with the commissioning of all the production units and feed processing equipment. Now, the equipment valued at over 2.3 million kwacha has been provided by the Food and Agriculture Organization, that is FAO, and the United Kingdom Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office. Now, speaking during the handover ceremony in Chirundu, Fisheries and Livestock Minister Peter Kampala said the equipment will significantly contribute to revitalizing livestock productivity in the country. Nakapala noted that government has implemented various measures to help livestock farmers remain productive in the face of climate change. We might take a listen to this discussion.
Testing the operations of the newly donated equipment for fodder production and hydroponic units in Chirundu district, this is Fisheries and Livestock Minister Peter Kapala and FAO country representative Suspes Philippine. These donated items are expected to boost livestock recovery in Chirundu and Namwale districts, thereby offering hope to farmers hit by the 2023-2024 El Nino-induced drought.
The drought we experienced was one of the most severe in Zambia's recent history. Its effects were devastating: dry pastures, water scarcity, and livestock losses hit our rural communities hard. My ministry, working with other relevant ministries and government agencies, together with our trusted partners, responded swiftly in a bid to address both emergency needs and long-term risks.
FAO has mobilized close to 9 million internal funding to support immediate relief interventions and to strengthen long-term resilience among vulnerable livestock farmers. Although the current 24-25 season has seen improved rainfall, the consequences of last season's drought remain deeply felt in communities here in Chirundu and Namwala and other parts of the country.
And Chirundu District Veterinary Officer Dr. Chisengabupe says over 1,600 cattle died due to starvation in the district triggered by the 2023-2024 El Nino-induced drought.
We were one of the districts that was heavily hit by the drought. Yes, we lost a number of animals, about 1,600 animals died as a result of starvation and dehydration. So we are delighted and to have this given to us.
Leo Mulopa is a beneficiary of the donated equipment for fodder production and hydroponic units.
Within 8 days, the harvest.
All right, it's 19 minutes in the after 6 o'clock, and this is early morning scoop. We still on the international segment and moving on to South Africa is that the 25 basic point cut has been widely welcomed as local consumers feeling the pressure of higher interest rates will get also some reprieve from the end of this month. Now, the Reserve Bank has cited lower inflation for its Monetary Policy Committee decision to drop the repo rate to 7.25% and the renting rate to 10.75%. Let's take a listen to this.
An economist at Liberty at
the MPC, in a period of cautiousness, given that there is a lot of uncertainty happening globally, but definitely the internal measures of the country pointing to a rate cut, we are seeing that GDP is not going to grow as well as we would have hoped. So the ideas of overheating are lost there. And our April CPI inflation, notably lower than what we've seen in the average for the last quarter, which is Q1 2025. So we have had a continued downward trajectory in our inflation rate, calling for a little bit of help for the economy. However, the MPC is looking and seeing that that might start to increase in the third quarter, and a little bit cautious just in terms of moving that repo rate down too far.
Obviously not surprising that the Reserve Bank would be cautious, but there is a glimmer of hope in terms of the outlook for further monetary policy easing. Talk to us about what you made in terms of the sentiment that was shared by the Reserve Bank governor, but at the same time what the market is expecting going forward.
Well, globally, lots of uncertainty. He did spend a little bit of time just kind of highlighting the global outlook in terms of GDP being slower, an indication that, you know, it might have a negative impact on our own economy. So definitely a warning there. One of the things that is mentioned just in terms of the supporting documents is that there is consideration for the target range to be moved a little bit down. So our midpoint at the moment is around 4.5%, and there's strong consideration around moving that to 3%. So where we are, we'd actually be in a position where there isn't much movement, given that April's number was around 2.3, and the average expected for 2025 is around that 3.2% mark. So, you know, it's still a bit of time. The Monetary Policy Committee is considering the impact of a lower inflation rate, inflation target. But if it should move to these numbers, we would not see further cuts. So some caution. There is easing inflationary pressure in some pockets. He mentioned fuel prices as one big example that impacts us at household level. But yeah, it is a time when policy is being considered, and that will influence what happens next.
I'm glad that you touched on that policy matter where inflation targeting is concerned. Is it a policy or a direction that South Africa should take, a metric that South Africa should be using, given that it has now spilled into the world of politics where it is sort of being used as a political tool as opposed to the independence of the South African Reserve Bank, ensuring that it stays with its mandate and it does not toe outside of those lines?
Yeah, so quite key in that there are two factors highlighted just in terms of conversations and questions during this session. One is that we often talk a lot about the consumer's position and those who are indebted when we talk about the interest rate, but seldom consider the other side of the saver and the person who tends to not have accumulated debt but is a net saver. Mm-hmm. So a big change now in terms of trying to really protect those who are savers in the economy, and hopefully that boosts a little bit in terms of investments and bonds and so on. The other element is trying to align ourselves with a global best practice, if I can call it that.
Yeah.
Our trade partners tend to have a lower inflation rate. It helps them in terms of managing volatility and creating some stability in their currencies as well. And I think the idea is for us to be better aligned to that so that we can see the same monetary stability on our end. So there are some strong, legitimate economic reasons for the consideration. And of course, it will have to take into account how it will impact households and economic growth as they go forward.
All right, there you have it. Now to move on to Zambia, is that a third round of technical negotiation between Zambia and Democratic Republic of Congo for the establishment of Ruapula and Rake-Moru Authority will take place tomorrow in Lusaka. Now, Water and Sanitation Minister says this follows successful discussion and the roadmap established during the second round in DLC. And we might take a listen to this discussion.
Democratic Republic of Congo have been holding negotiations for the agreement on the establishment of the Luapula River and Lake Mweru Authority. The envisaged agreement establishing a transboundary river basin organization will see the joint development of water resources in the Luapula River catchment. Water and Sanitation Minister Collins Nzovu has announced that the third round of negotiations will take place Friday, May 30, in Lusaka. This came to light during a bilateral meeting with the Water Convention Secretariat and the United Economic Commission for Africa on the sidelines of the PANAFCON 3 in Lusaka.
This initiative serves as a tangible illustration of Zambia's dedication to the principles of the Water Convention, especially in fostering joint institutions, joint legal frameworks, and joint cooperation at basin level.
The Water Convention Secretariat pledged its support to Zambia's process of being a member party to the Water Convention.
We stand ready to, as you said, facilitate discussions with CICOS about how we can bring Zambia into those meetings as an observer to understand better what the requirements will be.
Earlier, Mr. Nzovu held bilateral talks with his Moroccan counterpart, where the two discussed the proposed memorandum of understanding.
We believe we'll lay a robust foundation for cooperation in critical areas, including dam design and construction, thus enhancing our capacity to build and maintain sustainable water storage systems.
We have now 154 dams with the capacity of 20 billion cubic meters.
The minister also met with his counterpart from Malawi, Abida Siddiq. Sharon.
Right, you have it. Now, to move on to the next, or rather the last update of the day from the international segment, is that the regional leaders met in Ngada, calling for an immediate ceasefire and renewed dialogue to end the conflict in East Democratic Republic of Congo. And the summit attended by a representative, just that they focused on the worsening violence and humanitarian conditions. We might take a listen to this particular update.
The need for stronger coordination and respect for the sovereignty of member states. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni said the meeting was a vital step towards deeper regional cooperation in resolving conflicts. He called for unity and sustained political will to fully implement the peace, security and cooperation framework.
We know what the problem is, and it can be solved, but we must have the political will. And the foreigners should limit their involvement, because the foreigners are the ones who carelessly embolden the mistake makers. Then the mistake makers think that we don't care about these internal groups, we don't care about the region. What is important is the external support.
The meeting comes amid a worsening security and humanitarian crisis in eastern DRC. The Rwandan-backed M23 movement has seized swaths of territory despite calls for withdrawal. Leaders noted the need to strengthen efforts in conflict prevention and reconciliation.
Regional leaders have issued a stark warning. The escalating security situation in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo is a growing threat to regional stability. They urge urgent international intervention and an immediate ceasefire.
The call is clear. Warring factions must cease fire and resolve their differences through dialogue.
The ICGLR therefore calls upon the M23 to immediately and unconditionally stop its offensive and refrain from creating parallels.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHB on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Eight institutions in the Eastern DRC.
Several attempts by regional blocs have not yielded much. The previous summit was held in Burundi in May 2023, where leaders assessed progress in implementing the peace process. Leaders now reaffirm their commitment
to restoring peace and stability as part of efforts to silence the guns in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Isabel Nakiria, CGTN, Entebbe.
All right, there you have it. The time is 31 minutes in the of 6 o'clock, and this early morning scoop. We're going to take a listen to a very short commercial break, and then once we return, we'll take you through the local news update. Stay tuned.
Omutiha with the Kirakaguna, E. Matina Omjo. Chicago Safatana, Nana, Longishifa, Yai, Shuikamoshiwana, E. Moyao, or Tango Botisamwene. Anagashifa, Yanamibia, Ombitomba Nawa, Orangika. Faithanina, Omaguro, Nidanitoma, Yue, Yongashifa, Yokupitramo, Ikelefem Media House. Gwe 20 Meneha, Uka Kombanga Nina. Kara Omkashifareki, Wimopo, Yomo Programa Detu. Moambo, Dengera Selma, Konarajeta Kim, Datunda Tu, Heri Hamano Tano, Oniaj. Eagle FM, so I.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom.
All right, it's 32 minutes in the 6 o'clock in this early morning scoop, and welcome back. And if you just joined us right now, thank you so much and a very good morning to you. To start off, is that the wives by taxi driver have submitted their frustration regarding the outdated and upkeep transport permit system, which is said to date back many decades. Now, an observation that has been noted by the Minister of Works and Transport, Veiko Nekundi. Now, speaking to the taxi driver at the meeting with local taxi operators and drivers last Thursday, and Nekundi inquired that Namibia's transport permit system is quite chaotic. Now, he said some permit dated back to the 1970s had long since outlived their usefulness and were now enabling practices in this sector. Now, the minister, who has been vocal on the country's taxi permit, highlighted that the system of open permit created a corruption and abuse hotbed. Now, Nekundi said the permit are being subleased by non-owners for as much as $1,000 a month, and the actual owners of the vehicles do not have any say in their usage. Now, this is not just about the permits, it's about justice, livelihood, and dignity. Now, industry sources stated that such contracts tend to put drivers in vulnerable financial position with barely any long-term stability or rather regulatory protection. Now, Nekundi also commented on the recent strains that were brought on by traffic officials in the harbour town classification of taxi permit. Now, he revealed that his office and the presidency had been apprised of the crackdown and referred to it as a failure in communication and policy enforcement. Now, short of condemning the traffic officer's concern, Nekundi forwarded outdated policy that failed to reflect the realities of the current transport landscape. Now, they are operating using outdated frameworks. Now, we require regulatory reform for focusing on addressing the cause rather than just the symptoms, he said. Now, Nekundi cautioned against demonizing all those involved. They are good traffic officers, and of course, they are also bad traffic officers. As well as they are good politicians and bad politicians. So we cannot condemn everyone for the misdeeds of some, he said. Now, as a follow-up, the Minister of Works and Transport will begin phasing out all open-ended permit. Now, they will be also introduce a system of two-year renewable permit with allegedly limited to those who own road wealthy vehicles alone. Now, the application closing date is 30 September 2025, and completed application submitted on time will be processed on the same day. Now, the process will also allow for a period of public objection. Now, the statement was agreed with a guarded optimum by local drivers and owners, and taxi operators own the taxi operator Owen Nyambe termed the minister's action as a step in the right direction, and vehicle owner Robert Smith commended Nkundi for being willing to directly address the affected parties. Now, the taxi sector is an essential means of livelihood and transport, but traditional regulatory issues continue to erode stability in the sector. Now, the most operators, the government's new reform on permit is the right at the end of the tunnel that will usher in order and justice to the system. Now, moving on to the next item is that this year marks the 62th anniversary of the Organization of Africa Unit and the establishment of the African Union, a significant milestone in addressing the challenges and opportunities facing African Union's nations, we had a discussion with former Minister of Home Affairs, Immigration, Safety and Security, that is Daniel Kashikola, to unpack the importance of this particular occasion. We might take a listen to this particular update.
So as you are continue proceeding with our early morning scoop, so as they said, every 25th of May, the world comes together to commemorate Africa Day, a date transcends geographical boundaries to celebrate not only the cultural diversity and natural health of the world's most diverse continent, but also its determination to build a prosperous and united future. So Africa celebrated 62-day anniversary after the history of long transformation through colonial and post-colonial time. Today, we look back at Africa as a continent and how it changed in economic and human development. Like, where is the continent in terms of trade, food security, health, and technology? So today, we are going to engage Dr. Daniel Kashikola, the former Deputy Minister of Home Affairs, Immigration, Safety and Security, to tell us more about this. So, good morning, Daniel Kashikola, and welcome to Early Morning Scoop.
Good morning, Nelao.
Okay.
I'm very happy to have me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you maybe tell us how did the continent develop for the past 62 years?
It's a very interesting question, and it's not a very small question to answer. I mean, it's not a very straightforward to answer how the continent has developed for the last 62 years.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to look back at the formation of the Africa, Organization of African Union,
mm-hmm.
Way back in 1963, when the Africa, independent African countries, 30 African countries came together in Addis Ababa,
mm-hmm.
under the leadership of Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia. So the main purpose was to forge the unity for Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And that came from a philosophy or an understanding that Africa is one continent, and it ought to be independent.
Mm-hmm.
So those 30 independent countries vote that we are not independent as long as there's one country that is not independent in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore the idea of the formation of the African Organization of African Unity as an umbrella body that will oversee or promote or support support the cause of independence of Angola, the independence of Mozambique, the independence of Namibia, the independence of South Africa, and all other countries that include Zimbabwe, that include Zambia, so that Africa stand together as a united continent.
Mm-hmm.
So that is what transpired on that date, the 25th May 1963.
Mm-hmm.
So that also led to the formation of what is called the Africa Reparation Committee,
mm-hmm.
which was then a body through which this independent, the 30 independent countries will channel their support to the liberation movement in Sub-Saharan Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea of the African Day was that we need to we cannot talk about independence
mm-hmm.
Until every inch of the African continent is liberated.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot talk about development when we have some African countries that are still under colony.
Mm-hmm.
We have now so far the aims of the African unity has been achieved.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, there was an interruption there. So far the aim of achieving independence for Africa has been accomplished. It has been accomplished except there's one country that is still not independent, and this is colonized by another African country, that's Western Sahara,
mm-hmm.
that is under the colony of the Kingdom of Morocco.
Mm-hmm.
So to talk about the vision of the African leaders, the Kwame Nkrumah, the light of Emperor Haile Selassie and all others was actually to see to it that Africa is free and independent.
Mm-hmm.
So we as Namibia we are lucky also that the Sam Nujoma, the president of SWAPO at that time, and our founding president of the Republic of Namibia and the father of the Namibian revolution, was at the founding of that very organization that we call Organization of Africa, African Unity, which was later transformed to African Union.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the primary aim when was actually to support the liberation movement so that the whole of Africa can be free.
Mm-hmm.
Now after that, the idea was then we must also have one Africa, one government, one currency,
mm-hmm.
Towards a United States of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
That's the overall thinking from the beginning.
Okay. Can you maybe
tell us, like, what is the really theme of the African Day celebration, or why is May 23rd or 1963 referred to as African Day?
In your own the significance and why it is, it's important is that it is on that day when the African leaders resolved, enough is enough. Those of us who are independent now must support the cause, the anti-imperialist cause, the anti-colonialist cause, so that Africa can rise and shine again. We are celebrating the victory of the African people over colonialism, over imperialism.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My another question is that, what are some of the noted economic and technological changes in Africa?
There are quite many economic development that has taken place. We can talk about, first of all, we become independent on ourselves. We start trading among ourselves, although in that area we need to do more. We started now having our own sovereignty, and we are able to choose which country do we have a relation with and which country we trade with. Unlike before independence, where you only have to depend on the colonial master, but for now, Africa is free for us to be able to determine our own destiny. That's one. We have also created what is called Africa Continental Free Trade, which is the concept to say, hey, when we trade within Africa, we need to remove the tariffs. We need to ease the movement of goods and people. Those kind of things, and in some areas, like in SADC, we have started saying in SADC we remove the visa requirement for African to travel. For example, if you are coming from you are in Namibia to go to Angola, or you can go to Mozambique, you go to Tanzania, you go to any southern country, you go there visa free. So that is actually what we as Africa have achieved, for us to be able to promote our economic development. Yes, in terms of technology, Africa is not a silo. It is not a silo. It depends on each other. We depend, the world is a global village. We depend on each other's technology. So we cannot say solely that Africa has developed only on its own. It has developed its own technology, but in relation to other countries, other continents, because we are not in a silo. The world is not in a silo. We communicate, we relate with other countries. Yes, there are African countries that have gone a step ahead. We have had the Rwanda has also even launched it, his own satellite. In Namibia, we have the telecommunication, the fiber optic telecommunication. We have moved far away from the analog to digital transmission of information.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a number of developments specific generally to Africa and specific to individual African countries.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My last question is that, is the dream of United Africa soon to be reached, or what are the challenges, or what do you think about this?
Yeah, there are so many challenges. There are so many challenges. The vision, the vision of Africa still stand, that we need to be more united than we are. Agenda 2063 is very clear that we need to start integrating African integration. But it starts with the relations at the level of states, and then it moves to the relation of person to persons, and eventually we realize the integration of Africa as one continent, and facilitated through in the Africa trade. So we are getting it there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So thank you very much, Mr. Daniel Kaskola, for being with us on Early Morning Scoop. I would like to say have a blessed day ahead.
Thank you.
There you had it, dear listeners, there. The time is 53 minutes in the office o'clock, and you're just listening there to Daniel Kashikola, who emphasized more on Africa being united and not living in silo. So he said that Africa rather communicate to each other and not living in silos. Now, to move on to the next item, is that the 9 workers were resettled to farms valued at of 28 million Namibian dollars, covering a total of 11,026 hectares. Now, the ministry highlighted that the issue of landlessness predominantly affected generational farm workers, many of whom were born and raised on commercial farms. Now, the dire situation has become a national concern that requires an urgent and compassionate response from all stakeholders in the agriculture sector. That's what the minister said. Now, despite those efforts, the government has observed with great concern a troubling trend. Now, many individuals are forced to graze livestock and live in corridor, or rather on overcrowded farmlands due to the lack of access to land. Now, this trend is particularly evident in the Erongo, Harta, Pokunene, Karres, Omaheke, Oshikoto, and Otsozopa regions. Now, according to the ministry's analysis. Now, Zamani emphasized that the practice of forcibly evicting long-service generational farm workers and leaving them in corridors is not only inhuman, but also unacceptable. She urged all farmers owners to abandon such practices in favor of dialogue to seek a dignified and sustainable solution that uphold the rights and dignity of those who have contributed to our farms to generation. Now, in response to the resolution from the second National Land Conference, the government, through the Land Ministry, has been acquiring land with limited resources specifically to address the needs of affected communities, ensuring that no citizen is left to wander in corridors indefinitely. Now, in September 2024, the government incurred acquired two farms in the Omaheke region, which were subdivided into 8 farming units. Now, 6 of those units were assigned to the 9 beneficiaries. Samweni stated that the remaining 2 units will be allocated in due course to other group currently residing in Korido in the Omaheke region. Now, she encouraged those 9 beneficiaries to make the most of the life-changing opportunity by utilizing the land productively and, of course, sustainably, not only for those families' properties, but also to contribute to the national food security. That's what she said. However, she also cautioned them against allowing those not part of the formal allocation process to occupy the land. Now, and that's our in-house economist, Nilomena Erastus, will now discuss how optimize that the use of those newly acquired farmlands. So we might take a listen to this discussion.
How is the process of the resettlement benefited the previous disadvantaged people?
Yes. Look, the allocation of this plot to this individual is actually very significant, or it came at the right time, because as you know, like today we are commemorating or remembering the genocide or the killing of our brothers and sisters, our ancestors, the Namas and the Wairoro, mm-hmm. back into the 1900s. Or actually the first or one of the biggest genocide in the world, which is actually not really remembered, but as we are seeing that we have, our government has made the move now to remember this day, mm-hmm. even though we are late, mm-hmm. I think it is significant. And for the ministry actually to do this in the same week is very, very significant. And the connection is here. Remember these generational workers. Why did they become generational workers in the first? Because we have to add some context to this thing. Why did they become generational workers in the first place? It's because of the genocide. Mm-hmm. It's because their parents were killed, their parents were chased from their land. Mm-hmm. And the next generation actually started to become workers of the Germans. And even when the South African Boers took over, that continued, and that's why they are generational workers today, because they lost their land. Their parents lost land, their ancestors lost land. So for the ministry actually to allocate these farms, it is a very significant move when it comes to wealth creation, when it comes to correcting the injustice that has been done a long time ago. And it's one of those moves that we need to celebrate, even though it's just 9 people. And we are actually calling on our government to move a bit faster. We need to buy 3 or 4 or 4 or 5 farms every year, so that these people, we cannot have individuals that are willing. And remember, these people have been farming in those corridors with their goats and with their cattle. Mm-hmm. There is an indication that these people have courage. This is an indication that these people are willing not to be fed by anybody but to do it themselves. So it's very, very important actually for this news to come at this time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. What is it needed to make sure that these farmers are able to utilize the land that is allocated to them effectively?
Yes, and that is now one of the greatest questions, that you don't just allocate the land. We need to move away from this, because in the past, we have people that, yeah, no, the blacks were given land, or the previous disadvantaged were given land, but they do not utilize it. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to understand, why are these people not effectively or efficiently or economically utilizing the land that they get? Mm-hmm. Because if you do not equip them at the start very well, if you do not give them the necessary equipment and the necessary support at the beginning, mm-hmm. they are going to fail. Land is just the first step. But in utilizing the land economically, you need to give these people the necessary support. So we will get back probably to the ministry to hear, in those land that these people were given, are there functional boreholes for their animals to have access to water? Mm-hmm. Are they going to have an extension office actually literally stationed in Omaheke or Tsunjupa, wherever the farm is, which they can call anytime to say, my animal is sick or my animal is trying to give birth, but it has been now 2 hours and it's not delivered. And this extension worker is able to come to the farm on time. So those are some of the basic things that need to be there. And again, even if they want to sell two or three of their cattle, even if they want to sell milk, are they going to be connected to the market? Because remember, these are generational workers. They are not educated people like me and you. They only know how to farm. And if they want to sell something, it means the ministry has to be deliberately to connect them to the market. And all the support need to be there at this beginning. So the ministry also need to come in and to elaborate that what support is going to be given to these generational farmers for them to study their journey. And for us to be able to say, what have you done for the past 5 years? You have now given land. So in because in the past, we get to ask them questions. Yeah, they've been given land, but they didn't do anything. But we now need to make sure we give them the necessary support as a ministry, as a country, as a government, due to what they have gone through, due to what their parents and their grandparents, their ancestors have gone through, so that we can position them to be better in society. It's just not the land alone, but the necessary support in terms of equipment and also in terms of training need to be there for them to be very effective. Otherwise, they are still going to be failed, and we're going to say black people can't, the Nama people can't, the Wairoa people can't, what to them. No, but it's because it's also failed to give them the necessary support at the beginning so that they can start their journey.
Okay, we are speaking of giving them support and so on, but how can we motivate and hold the farmers accountable to avoid the misuse of this land and those allocated, this land that is allocated to them? What really way are we going to put there to make sure that whatever they are given, or this land that they are given, or the tools that they are given, are being used in the right way and they are not being misused?
Yeah, also that is very good. We call it monitoring and evaluation, providing oversight. And that is something that our government or ourselves have been very weak on. As I said, these are generational workers who just have the courage to provide livelihood for themselves. They will need a lot of support. They will need a lot of monitoring and evaluation and oversight. Like I said at the beginning, the ministry need to have an extension worker tailor-made for them. Not only to train them, but also to make sure everything given to them is being utilized as needed. Like me Inge said in her speech, to say, make sure you go utilize this land. Make sure you use this land like it was given to you. We cannot just say like that in speeches and be at window and expect people to follow. No. So an extension worker, the Minister of Agriculture extension worker, need to be stationed closer to these people every week, ensuring that oversight is being provided. That no animals are going to be sold, the land is not going to be sold or given to certain people, no. So they have to make sure of that. So we cannot just give land or say, go now, we gave you land, and come back next day and say, these people are lazy or the people sold the land. No. We have to provide the necessary monitoring and evaluation, the oversight, to ensure their success. We cannot just let them be like that. So, and be at our head office in Windhoek and say, no, we gave them and they sold it. No, an extension worker need to be stationed closer to these people to ensure that their journey is really is going to be a good one. They get the necessary support and the guidance, and oversight is provided to ensure nothing is sold. Because if things don't work, remember, as I try to raise a 3 cattle and 4 cattle and all of them die, what do you expect me to do? I'll sell the land. I'll sell the cattle. But if you provide oversight and the necessary support on time, I will not lose courage. I will keep continuing because I have the support and I know you are there to monitor. And that is what is needed at the beginning here. Because if I don't feel confidence in my ability and in my animals are dying, I will sell the land. So it's good that the ministry need to be there to provide that oversight to ensure the land is effectively used as it's supposed to be.
That is very well said. Maybe is there any other advice that you are willing to say out to especially these people that are allocated to this land?
Maybe for me it's to the ministry, because I know that people are not going to are not listening, but I know part of the ministry people are listening. Look, or part of government people, look, it is a good initiative, like I said in the beginning. Like, we are commemorating and remembering the genocide. The ancestors of these people are the one who started this journey. The loss of wealth, the loss of everything started a long time ago. And now we are doing great to ensure that we don't just neglect them and forget about them and to say what and what. No, we are doing what we're supposed to do collectively and giving them land. So what I will say is that we continue to give them the support. For only 2 years, we need to give them the necessary support so that they can start their farming journey in good foundation. They cannot start their farming journey where water is missing, the other goat is sick, and nobody to provide training, no access to capital. No, we make sure we give them such a conducive ecosystem for them to be able to deliver or to build the wealth from themselves as they deserve. And they deserve it, especially for this week of genocide that we are commemorating. We need to give the necessary support to them. That is how we build the country, and that's how we are remembering this day. Let the minister and the government give the necessary support to this generation of farm workers.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Nginomen Mavali Erastes. That was our economist for this morning. May you have a nice day, sir.
You're welcome, ma'am.
All right, there you have it. Now, additionally, my colleague David Shombe also spoke to Mr. Beva, one of the beneficiaries of this farmland, who might take a listen to their discussion.
Yes, we are continuing with early morning scoop. We are looking at economic development, and we are also looking at contribution of Namibian government to food security. It was indicated that yesterday the Ministry of Agriculture, Water, and also Fishery hand over farms to 9 beneficiaries who have been working in those farms. Some have been grazing in the corridors, and they were officially given letters yesterday. However, I got into the conversation with Mr. Baeva, who is here representing his mother, and just to talk about what have happened, how he is feeling, and how he is going to work in this farm, or how he's going to make this land productive. Mr. Baeva, good morning and welcome to Early Morning Scoop.
Yeah, good morning, sir. I'm very happy that my mother got a land allocated letter. I'm very happy that my mother got a resettlement letter from the government.
Yes.
And since we were living at Farms Kornit for the past 33 years,
yeah.
I remember when we got to Kornit, I was 7 years old,
yeah.
And I'm happy that my mother got a permanent resettlement farm.
Yes, I've seen the excitement. How is this farm going to be utilized, or how are you going to operate, or you have already started doing something?
We have already started doing something. It's just that we normally farm with cattle,
yeah.
And when we're here at Kornit,
yeah.
Where we have stayed for the past 33 years,
yeah.
We have lost a number of cattle because of drought.
Yeah.
I'm sure now that my mother got a bigger piece of land,
yeah.
Which is 1,300,
yeah.
I think we can do a better part in farming.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes, who owned that farm before? Who owned the farm before?
It's the government. This farm is owned by the government, but it's a project for the San community.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, now that you are your new boss, how are you going to utilize this farm once again? And do you guys got any assistance, or do you still require any technical assistance in terms of utilizing this farm?
Yeah, we'll require some assistance because the governor also stated there that there will be some grant or something,
yeah.
But we're looking to go into production now and to get more kills,
yeah.
and do crop production.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Abem, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, sir.
All right, the time is 10 minutes in the off 7 o'clock, and this is Early Morning Scoop. We have about 20 minutes to cruise over to my colleague at the mic, Oshoveli. Now, to move on is that the 4 years, Namibia has struggled to feed its population, leading to widespread hunger. Now, Eagle FM engaged with Aaron Angola, an agricultural commodities observer, just to discuss the good harvest season and what Namibia farmers can do to effectively store their food. We might take a listen to this subject.
Yes, we are continuing with Early Morning Scoop. We are looking at economic development, and we are also focusing on, harvesting season, and also what need to be done, particularly when it's coming to storage of food. And yeah, it was indicated that in 2025, it has been a breast year in terms of rainfall after few consecutive years without adequate rainfall. However, today we are going to look at harvesting season, what farmers got, and also if the investment that they put in worth the return. Now, I got into the conversation with Arona Angola, who is an agricultural observer, and just to help us unpack this. Mr. Arona, good morning, and welcome to Early Morning Scoop. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Let's start with this harvesting season. As an observer of agricultural commodities, how do you rate this year expected harvest?
Okay. From my personal observation, I think the answer will differ from location to location.
Yeah.
From farmer to farmer. Largely, yes, there's going to be a bumper harvest in some parts of the country,
yeah.
But also no in other parts for several reasons that I'll mention. Firstly, because I think in terms of rainfall, the rainfall patterns were irregular. This means that we didn't have good rainfall throughout the whole season.
Yeah.
If you look, for example, there was very little rain during the planting season. This is the months of normally November, December, and sometimes also during January. So some farmers will have planted early.
Yeah.
Their crops will germinate.
Yeah.
But then they will lose some of the crops due to extended periods of without rainfall.
Mm-hmm.
For example, 2 to 3 weeks when it doesn't rain, and you know, some of the crops will dry, others will still survive. And I think most of the farmers who planted early would have experienced this. So,
mm-hmm.
Some of the farmers who planted late towards the end of January and beginning of February will have better harvest than those who planted earlier and experienced this extended period of rainfall. Secondly, some of the crops that have survived were damaged by too much water. If you observe, you would see that there were, for example, there was excessive rainfall in some parts, and normally excessive rainfall can damage fruit crops through several mechanisms, waterlogging being one,
yeah,
which deprives plants from plant roots from accessing oxygen, and therefore hindering nutrient uptake and growth.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the seedlings that might have germinated, and even the bigger crops or the older crops that have grown can be destroyed by flooding and too much rain towards the footing. And for example, in Hangwena region, some part of Hangwena or Omsati, Kunene, not Kunene, but Oshana, and in the Zambezi, for example, where you experience floods.
Yeah.
Farmers that are on lower grounds, some of their crops will then be washed away, and which will impact on your harvest as a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if you have too much rain towards the fruiting season, when the crop has now started putting on fruit or has put on fruit, and there's too much rain, then that could also result into the cob rotting.
Yeah, yeah.
Which also then, you know, damage your harvest. So all these factors will play a role in the amount of harvest that the farmer can generate from their field. So as I said, some farmers in the flood prone areas of Zambezi or Hangwena, Shana and Omsati might not get good harvest, but others in other parts, let's say the eastern part of Ohangwena, some part of Osh, most part of Oshikoto, if the farmers planted, during maybe January, will of course, will definitely observe bamba harvest. So, I think it's a 50-50 thing if you look at it. In some part you will have farmers harvesting quite a good harvest.
Yeah.
But in some areas you'll have farmers, being challenged by some of those factors that I've mentioned, and therefore their harvest will be reduced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now, in comparison to the past 3 years, a lot of Namibians have expectation to say this is going to be one of the better harvesting season. What is your view on this?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I agree that, of course, this year will be better than the previous years, as you mentioned. I mean, we've got more rain, in comparison to the previous years. So, yes, I agree that, this year, most farmers will get, and those who don't get will probably have an opportunity then to buy from those who will have surplus harvests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, now let us look at food storage and also looking at preservation of food. Given now the expected harvest, what can the country do to improve on, food storage and also avoiding losses of some food? What are some of the better methods to make sure that we save these products for a longer term?
Okay, I think as a country, in terms of storage, there's not so much that needs to be done. Unless, of course, the hundreds and thousands of farmland that are laying idle are put to productive use. By this I mean, some of the commercial farms out there that could be used, that needed to be utilized to produce crop or produce food, but are not being utilized. So I think, in terms of storage, both government and the private sectors have already invested, sufficiently enough in good storage to accommodate our current production capacity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying this, still given our dependency on import of our staple and mostly maize from South Africa. So if you are still importing this major staple, then it means you are not producing enough. So what do you need added storage capacity for if you can't produce enough?
Mm-hmm.
So I think what in terms of storage, what is in existence is quite sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
And, at the moment, in terms of crop production, we are looking at areas in terms of commercial production. We are looking at Ocho Gonjupa. And Oshikoto.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking about the maize triangle. That is the farms between Otavi, Kroonstad, and Tsume.
Yeah.
I think the farmers there, from my own perspective, the commercial farmers there must have or should have invested in some kind of food storage facility
mm-hmm.
for their maize, unless they sell it on the COP. Now, if you look at the rest of the country.
Yeah.
Crop production is mostly taking place in the northern communal area, which starts from, the banks of the Zambezi to Kunene.
Yeah.
Maybe not so much Kunene.
Yeah.
I think the government in those parts has invested in good crop storage facility in the form of government silos.
Yeah.
Which are placed at different strategic locations across those regions.
Mm-hmm.
A few examples are, the silos in Katima Mulilo.
Yeah.
Which caters for those maize producing farmers in that part of the country. If you also look at all the government grain schemes, there are storage facilities, good storage facilities, silos, to cater for whatever production is generated from those grain schemes. You also have then towards, the western part of the country, the western part of the NCA. In Okongo, for example, where you have silos, government silos.
Yeah.
In Sandy, you have government silos. This one's already caters for those mango producing farmers in those areas.
Yeah.
And traditionally, our farmers will always preserve their crops to sustain them for an extended period without major issues.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I said, unless we are able to exceed the capacity of the current facilities in existence, then I don't see the need
for us to look at further at further storage.
Yes.
In terms of preservation, unless we are looking at, we can then look at some kind of value addition equipment, you know, to enhance the shelf life of our crops. I think there's not really so much that can be done, not from my point of view.
Yeah, just when we are at that point, there's also what the question regarding, you know, when farmers, particularly in the northern part of Namibia, when they receive a good rain, they get a good harvest. However, there are those materials that they either leave in the field that should or were supposed to be used either for, you know, other products, or can also be used for as a supplement to animals. But in terms of now using wisely what you have got from a good harvest, either it's a product itself, if there remains, what can be done in that regard?
I think, as you said, we can take some of those, especially the reminders, to convert them to animal feed.
Yeah,
there is a lot of pelleting machines flying around, so we can look at some of those simple technologies that our people are able to afford. In order for them to be able to add value to some of those products that are, let's say if you're producing maize, all you need from maize really is a maize cob.
Yeah.
That is what you know, you take that and then you still, you know, either you mill now your maize and sell, or you store in some kind of barn or something. Mm. But what happens to the rest of the maize plant then? You can then, you know, turn that into some kind of animal feed, but then for that you need technology. Traditionally, we used to cut those, put under on top of trees,
yeah,
and basically give our animals during the season when there's not enough animal feed.
Mm-hmm.
So, looking at, I think, providing or subsidizing some of those technologies to allow farmers then to convert the leftovers into
animal feed.
Yes, into animal feed, but into a formation that can easily be stored. Yeah, like pellets, for example, so that you put them in some beds, and then you can store them in dry places.
Mm-hmm.
That would be, I think, something that I would be happy to see happening.
Yes. Maybe the last question, Mr. Arana, just to look at food storage in general, particularly after a very good harvest. What is the relevance or the importance of, or the impact of, you know, food storage on the long term food security for the household?
I think food storage at the household level is important for food security and household self-sustenance in the long term or in the long run.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned earlier, traditionally and even now, our farmers, our parents, and even ourselves,
mm-hmm,
we've always ensured our food security at household level by preserving our harvest or our crops to sustain us for an extended period. So we are known as subsistence farmers,
yeah,
because we farm for our own consumption first before we think of the market.
Yeah.
We only sell when there is enough surplus.
Yeah.
But the main aim is to ensure that there is enough for the family for at least a year or two. So how do you ensure this? By, of course, storing, you know, your harvest, by not selling, by not going ahead of yourself and selling this food and expecting that there'll be good rainfall the following year. So household food storage is even more important now, with the current state of rainfall patterns and with climate change playing its role. The next season is not cannot be guaranteed.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose many farmers would prefer to keep their crop by storing them instead of selling them. So I really think that yes, it's quite important that households store some food.
All right. There you had it. The time is 24 minutes in the of 7 o'clock, and this is early morning scoop. Now, to move on to the last update of the day, is that the Okongo constituency reported two elephant sightings in the area to Eagle FM. And now my colleague Sharon Seaman spoke with Elizabeth Njulume just to provide further details on this particular update.
As we are continue proceeding with our early morning scoop, so the Okongo constituency has reported two elephants in the area. So on this, we are going to engage with Elizabeth Njulume to tell us more about this, what is really happening in Okongo about the elephants that are in the area of Okongo constituency. So good morning, Elizabeth, and welcome to early morning scoop.
Good morning. How are you? Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, thank you. Elizabeth, can you tell us, so how often do the elephants attack the crop fields for the human beings during the harvesting season?
When it comes to elephant intrusions into crop fields, especially in areas like Okongo, they are unfortunately quite common because those areas are near, like they are near wildlife corridors. So especially in those of the fact that it's during the harvesting season. So these, I think during the harvesting season, these animals like elephants, they are drawn by the smell, and also the fact that there's abundance of food now, like the maize, the millet, the mahangu, like the sorghum that's actually grown, and those are the things that attract those elephants. Those elephants there. So I don't really have like a daily statistics on how often this event or how often the elephants attack the crop field. But one thing I noticed that it rises significantly between the month of March and June, because this is actually the month of the harvesting season. Mm-hmm. And these are the things that actually attract those. Yeah. So it's quite common, and it's devastating for the subsistence farmers, for our farmers in the areas, because they are losing out now, because if the farms, the crop farms are now destroyed, that means that there's a lot of food, and they won't be able to harvest anymore, and also they are losing out on their income as well. So it's quite concerning and it's quite sad. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. So okay. So it is currently a harvest season, Elizabeth. So how can citizens work together with the wild animals to live in harmony?
Okay, so I think when we speak of coexisting, I think it has to begin with understanding and respect, obviously, from both sides as well. So I think like the citizens, like the community members, they can work together by forming, let's say, community-based wildlife management groups. So especially those areas that where those elephants are reported or commonly reported, so that these groups or this group can like monitor and report elephant movements that are there as well. And also maybe just also looking at the traditional knowledge that we also have, because even growing up, we have certain, like when it comes to elephants, there are certain beliefs or there are certain knowledges that we have when elephants are actually approaching, or some certain roads that are already known, that this is a pathway for like elephants that is like traditionally known also. So I think also like in creating awareness, obviously with community members, educating community members on how they can best protect themselves, on how they can actually behave when they are also faced with this situation. So I think this harmony is possible if like the communities, the conservancies or conservationists, if they are available in those areas, and authorities can like work hand in hand, that can now be through educational movement or awareness, prevention, also the respect for people and respect for wildlife as well. So, yeah.
Okay, what alternative measures or maybe precautions can be implemented to keep wild animals away from people, especially in this situation or during this season?
Yeah, okay. So I think, like I said, I think education and training is very important when it comes to those communities. Because those communities need to be trained on animal behaviors, the safety precautions that they can actually take when they find themselves in those situations, and some of the early warning signs that they can actually get when an elephant is actually in an area. It can even be maybe a solar-powered light that turns on when an elephant approaching an area or something like that. Or just like basic knowledge that community members can actually possibly make sure that themselves, they are safe when an elephant come in the community, that they are safe and the elephant is also not hurt. Because now we just also act on our instinct, or we just also act now trying to protect our crops and trying to protect ourselves as well. But if we know on how to deal with elephants or wildlife animals as well, then it will be easier to, I think, to avoid some of these damages that are brought within communities and to the animals as well. And also just now having the watch groups or the community groups that can be formed as well, so that these community groups will be able to protect other community members, or like if there is like an elephant that is reported in the other community, then they can be, they know on what to do, or they know the right people to actually report this to, or the right office to actually do that.
Alright, you had the time is 31 minutes in the off 7 o'clock. This was Early Morning Scoop. Thank you so much for staying with us. And I'll be heading over, rather I'll hand over to my colleague at the Microsoft ready to take us through the unpacking of the day. From Miloy Sashimi, it's a good day.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
Omutiha, utekiroka guna, I matina omjo. Chikao shafasa na nana, nongeshifa, ya eshiwike moshiwana. Iye moyawo, ota ingongoti samwene. Anangeshifa, ya Namibia, ombitombwa na wa oronjika. Seitha nina omayakuro nirandithoma yoe, yongeshefa yoe kupitira mo Eagle FM Media House. Ngoe tuende timemeha uka kombanga nina. Kara omkwashipareki uimopo yomo programa detu. Moambo, dengira selma, konarahita tuimu. Datundatu, heari hamano tano, oniaji. Eagle FM, so aye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? Either a person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.